How strong is our faith? This is a question that we have heard many times past sermons. It's a question that we're going to be hearing many more times in future sermons. But I'm going to ask you that question today because it's a question for myself as well as for anybody else, especially when you would think in the bigger picture, insignificant situations could affect our faith and in our thinking. Well, the day will come when we may have to prove to God and to ourselves how much we really trust in Him. Not talking about where we are now, but what's really going to happen in the future. It may be difficult to fathom the idea just how bad this world is going to get when we read about what is prophesied, and especially when we will be hated by the entire world for the things that we believe. That time of utter destruction has not come yet. And that's why I bring about that point, how difficult it is right now to comprehend that. How far will we go to stand up for the truth when we are put on the spot? Now, history has shown this in the past with wars that we have gone through already, how people stood up for what they believed and they were killed for it. I would like to go over in detail a true story about bravery and uncompromising faith, which showed no fear even in the face of death. And that is the title of my sermon, In the Face of Death. It's a very familiar story. It is actually one of my favorite stories in the Bible. And doing some research on this, I can't even recall the last time the story was even covered in a recent sermon by itself, but I believe the last time it was touched upon was a sermon given by Edwin Pope, and that was about 10 years ago. So I thought enough time has passed to go over this story in much more detail and share it with you today. If you could please turn to Daniel chapter 1. If you haven't figured it out yet. Daniel chapter 1 will begin in verse 1 to read through verse 8. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his God, and he brought the articles into the treasure house of his God. Then the king instructed Ashpenaz, the master of the eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace, and whom they might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. Verse 5, the king appointed for them a daily provision of the king's delicacies and of the wine which he drank, and 3 years of training for them, so that at the end of that time they might serve before the king. Now from among those sons of Judah were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. To them the chief of the eunuchs gave names. He gave Daniel the name Belteshazzar, to Hananiah Shadrach, to Mishael Meshach, and to Azariah Abednego. But Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now, this here in verse 8, would not defile himself. What does that mean? This right here is a temptation that he was faced with, as we see in verse 5, where the king had appointed the king's delicacies, right? So going on some commentaries that I had researched with, you notice that Barnes' commentary notes, the word which is rendered defile himself means to be defiled, to be polluted, to be unclean. The defilement here referred to in the case of Daniel probably was that by partaking of this food, he might in some way be regarded as countenancing idolatry or as lending his sanction to a mode of living which was inconsistent with his principles and which was perilous to his health and morals, nor with the wine that he drank as being contrary to his principles and perilous to his morals and happiness. Now, it is not improbable that the food which was offered had been in some way connected with idolatry, and that his participation in it would be construed as supporting the worship of idols. It is known that a part of the animals offered in sacrifice was sold in the market, and known also that splendid entertainments were often made in honor of particular idols and on the sacrifices which had been offered to them. Let's compare this to 1 Corinthians, where it gives such a warning. 1 Corinthians chapter 8. And we will read 1 through 13. And verse 1, "Now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. If anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing, yet as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, this one is known by him. Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. For even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father of whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we live. However, there is not in any one that knowledge, or some, with consciousness of the idol, until now eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled." Verse 8, "But food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we do not eat are we the worse. But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble." So here it talks about conscience as well. Now, Daniel was very well aware of this, which is why he made this proposal to the eunuch. They did not want to partake of foods that, for one, could be connect in some way with idol worship, or two, well, first of all, because it could also be considered unclean. Now, Clark's commentary on this says that the chief reasons why Daniel would not eat meat from the royal table were probably these three. Like I mentioned, because they ate unclean beasts, which are forbidden by Jewish law, because they ate, as did the heathens in general, beasts which had been strangled or not properly blooded, because the animals that were eaten were first offered as victims to their gods. It is on this account that the Athenaeus calls the beasts which here served up at the tables of the Persian kings. Now also during that time, as Barnes' commentary quotes saying, a considerable part of the food which was served up at the royal table consists of items which, by the Jewish law, were prohibited as unclean. It was customary among the ancients to bring a portion of what was eaten and drank as an offering to the gods, as a sign of thankful recognition that all which men enjoy is their gift. Hence, Daniel and his friends regarded what was brought from the royal table as food which had been offered to the gods and therefore as impure. Now, we read about that in the first few verses of Daniel when it's talking about the gods of this, the gods of that, and we know King Nebuchadnezzar's background, and we knew that he obviously had offered to his God, not the true God. But we'll go more into that as the story continues. Now, we must consider the fact that, as I mentioned, Daniel was very well educated, as were the three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And they had godly wisdom. They had been trained in the ways of strict temperance. But now, there had been new scenes that had opened up to them. New temptations were before them, as this one right here. They were among strangers. They were noticed. They were flattered. They had an opportunity of indulging in the pleasures of the table, such as a captive youth rarely enjoyed. And this is exactly what they were. They were captives. What really did they have to lose, right? This opportunity, there can be no doubt they regard it as a temptation to their virtue, and as in the highest degree perilous to their principles, and they therefore sought to resist the temptation. Rare has it been that a youth in such circumstances like these would form the steady purpose not to defile himself by the tempting allurement set before him, and that, at all hazards, he would adhere to the principles in which he had been educated. Now, knowing all this, it was a request by Daniel that he may not defile himself. He sought a gentle approach rather than the opposite. And that, too, was very important because it also had found favor in the eyes of God. Notice in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7. For God has not given us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and of a sound mind, also self-control. And ties in pretty well with the editorial of this week from Brian Gale, how self-control and politeness can get you far in life. Not the other way around. See, this is where we need to use our wisdom when in situations like this. What we have been taught whenever we're in such predicament, as in Proverbs chapter 1, verse 7 says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and instruction. Continuing on in verse 9. Now God had brought Daniel into the favor and goodwill of the chief of the eunuchs. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who has appointed your food and drink. For why should he see your faces looking worse than the young men who are your age? Then you would endanger my head before the king. So Daniel said to the steward whom the chief of the eunuchs had set over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days. Let them give us vegetables to eat and water to drink. Verse 13, let our appearance be examined before you, and the appearance of the young men who eat the portion of the king's delicacies, and as you see fit, so deal with your servants. So he consented with them in this matter and tested them 10 days. And at the end of the 10 days, their features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate the portion of the king's delicacies. Thus the steward took away their portion of delicacies and the wine that they were to drink, and gave them vegetables. So we see here in verse 10, as the chief eunuch fears his king, Daniel also, and more importantly, fears God, thereby putting trust in God, and is willing to put his faith to the test, knowing in confidence that Daniel is doing what he is doing is right. Since Daniel found favor in the chief of the eunuchs, the chief was willing to grant Daniel his wish, and also, since it was to be for such a short time, for 10 days, that he ran little risk in this matter, because at the end of the 10 days, he supposed that it would be easy to change their mode of diet if the trial was unsuccessful. Now, reading from Gill's commentary, when it comes to verse 15, at the end of the 10 days, the features appeared better and fatter in flesh than all the young men who ate a portion of the king's delicacies. At the end of these 10 days, their countenances appeared fairer and fatter in flesh. At the time fixed for the trial of them, when they came to be examined, they appeared to be of a better complexion and more healthful look, and even plumper and fatter with good solid flesh is what it's really referring to here, not swelled up as persons in a dropsy or edema, which is a condition characterized by excess of watery fluid collecting in the cavities of tissues of the body. And guess what? You will get that if you eat enough of it from unclean foods. Now also let's notice, as we read on, in verse 17 through 21 we read, "As for these young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams." So here they had special gifts. "Now at the end of the 10 days, or end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. Then the king interviewed them, and among them all none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Therefore they served before the king. And in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in all his realm. Thus Daniel continued until the first year of King Cyrus." Now, one more thing I wanted to point out when it comes to the number 10. You know, 10, as we know in the Bible, has the significance of the number of judgment. So really, they were judged after 10 days of trying this new diet to see if they were worthy enough. And with such a... because the king is all about the outward appearance as well. So because they had the better-looking outward appearance, that granted favor for them as well. And so doing the whole interviewing process with them, it was just a step up that would help in his decision. Now let's read in chapter 2, starting in verse 1 through 8. We read, "The second year of Nebuchadnezzar's reign, he had dreams. His spirit was so troubled that his sleep left him. The king gave the commands to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans to tell the king his dreams. So they came and stood before the king. The king said to them, 'I have had a dream. My spirit is anxious to know the dream.' The Chaldeans spoke to the king in Aramaic, 'O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will give the interpretation.' The king answered, said the Chaldeans, 'My decision is firm. If you do not make known the dream to me and its interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces. Your houses shall be made as an ash heap. However, if you tell the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts, rewards, and great honor. Therefore, tell me the dream and its interpretation.' They answered again, said, 'Let the king tell his servants the dream, and we will give his interpretation.' The king answered and said, 'I know for certain that you would gain time because you see that my decision is firm.'" In other words, they saw that they couldn't comply with his request in hopes to buy some time or delay that he may put off the execution, or to come up with something to appease him or perhaps escape altogether. The king is also smart here because he can see by the reaction of them, of the magicians and, you know, his wise counsel, that they didn't have an answer. So instead, the king demanded that his wise men not only interpret a troubling dream he has had, but tell him the dream itself without him giving a hint of what it was. A big test put upon them. And now in verse 9, "If you do not make known the dream to me, there is only one decree for you. For you have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me till the time has changed. Therefore tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can give me its interpretation." Verse 10, "The Chaldeans answered the king and said, 'There is not a man on earth who can tell the king's matter. Therefore no king, lord, or ruler has ever asked such things of any magician, astrologer, or Chaldean.' Verse 11, "It is a difficult thing that the king requests, and there is no other one who can tell it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." Barnes' commentary notes on this, "The idea is not so much that the king demanded by the king was uncommon or rarely made, though that it was true, as that it was so difficult to be beyond the human powers, a matter of that kind would not be disclosed except by divine assistance. Now, the magicians and the Chaldeans and all them, they recognize that fact. There's nothing they can do about it, only through God. It would seem from this that these persons did not claim to be inspired, or to have communication with the gods, or at least that they did not claim to be inspired by the supreme God, but that they relied on their own natural discernment. But it's interesting that they recognize that fact, you know, that they are obviously not the wisest. I mean, they're telling him right there, they are not the wisest in all the land. How many times do you hear that today? You know, So anyway, going to the next verse, in verse 12 and 13, for this reason the king was angry and very furious, gave the command to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. So the decree went out, and they began killing the wise men. They sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Clark's commentary on the Bible notes on these two verses that they sought Daniel and his fellows, the three, as the decree stated that all the wise men of Babylon should be slain. The four young Hebrews, being reputed among the wisest, were considered as sentenced to death also. Obviously, the king had forgotten about them at this point, because his anger took over, and we know what happens when anger takes over. Going to the next verse in 14 and 15, then with counsel and wisdom, Daniel asked Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree from the king's so urgent or so harsh? Then Arioch made the decision known to Daniel. Barnes comments on this. Daniel was surprised. After the favor and honor with which he had been received at the court in the first chapter, 19 and 20, and the confidence which had been reposed to him or in him, a command like this should have been issued so comprehensive as to embrace him and his friends, when they had done nothing to deserve the displeasure of the king. And like I said, this shows how anger can blind people to the point where they lose control. As if the king had completely forgot about Daniel and his friends. And that is exactly what happened. Now, we see how Daniel responds in this situation. Verse 16. So Daniel went in and asked the king to give him time, that he might tell the king the interpretation. Then Daniel went to his house, made the decision known to the three, his companions, and they might seek mercies from the God of heaven concerning the secret, so that Daniel and his companions might not perish with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Then the secret was revealed to Daniel in a night vision, or in a dream. So Daniel blessed the God of heaven, and Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. He changes the times and the seasons. He removes kings and raises up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise, knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and secret things. He knows what is in the darkness, and light dwells with him. I thank you and praise you, O God of my fathers. You have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me that we asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's demand. Now, he was in a very difficult situation, because he's about to be killed. And what does he do? He prays about it, and he gives all acknowledgement to God for the skills that he has, which is given from him. This power of prayer is an acknowledgement to God, recognizing the gifts, recognizing the power and the wisdom, where it all comes from. We read about in James 1:17, we actually heard about in the last sermon, about gracious gifts. John 3, verse 27 says, a man can receive nothing unless it is given to him from heaven. And that is exactly what Daniel had recognized and exactly what he was praying for. And now in verse 24, where Daniel starts to explain the dream, from verse 24 through 30, we read, "Therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, 'Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Take me before the king. I will tell the king the interpretation.' Then Arioch quickly brought Daniel before the king and said thus to him, 'I have found a man of the captives of Judah who will make known to the king the interpretation.' The king answered and said to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, 'Are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and its interpretation?' Daniel answered in the presence of the king and said, 'The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men, the astrologers, the magicians, and the soothsayers cannot declare to the king. But, verse 28, there is a God in heaven who reveals secrets. He has made known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head upon your bed were these. As for you, O king, thoughts came to your mind while on your bed about what would come to pass after this. And he who reveals secrets has made known to you what will be.'" And verse 30, "But as for me, this secret has not been revealed to me, because I have more wisdom than anyone living, but for our sakes who make known the interpretation of the king, and that you may know the thoughts of your heart." Daniel boldly told the king that the wise men could not reveal it, but only through God was it possible, who presides over all people and things on earth, that to him alone belongs the revelation of secrets, and not to the heathen gods, the idols, or to any magician, astrologer, etc. The gods, the magicians, the astrologers, who he followed, who he believed. So that was a bold statement by Daniel. His words were carefully planned, though, on what to say, which is why he prayed, you know, for wisdom and counsel in this matter. He wasn't quick to react. That's why he asked for time. So he carefully planned it out, because he had said that God alone must reveal the signification of this dream. The king might have asked why Daniel undertook to interpret it, and therefore he shows that he was but God's minister and had no gifts but those which God had given him to set forth his glory. Let's look in Acts chapter 3. Acts chapter 3, verse 11 and 12. "Now as a lame man who was healed held on to Peter and John, all the people ran together to them in the porch, which is called Solomon's, greatly amazed. So when Peter saw it, he responded to the people, 'Men of Israel, why do you marvel at this, or why look so intently at us, as though by our own power of godliness we have made this man walk?'" Notice what Peter is trying to tell everybody. It's not him who did this. It is through God that made this happen. And this is exactly what Daniel was telling Nebuchadnezzar, that it wasn't going to be through his power that this was going to happen, but through God the Father. Now, I'm not going to go over the dream itself. So I'm going to skip over to verse 46 through 49. So after he had explained the dream to Nebuchadnezzar, and verse 46, "The king Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, prostrate before Daniel, and commanded that they should present an offering and incense to him. The king answered Daniel and said, 'Truly, your God is the God of gods, the Lord of kings, and a revealer of secrets, since you could reveal this secret.' Then the king promoted Daniel and gave him many great gifts, and he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon, and chief administrator over all the wise men of Babylon. Also Daniel petitioned the king and set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel sat in the gates of the king." This was now the second time the king had found favor in Daniel and his three friends. They escaped death by having faith and confidence in God that he would take care of the situation. And in contrast, their lives were spared and also were promoted to be rulers of the province of Babylon. On to chapter 3. In verse 1 through 7, we read, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. Didn't really take much from the following verse to this to disregard God of heaven, but going right back to his old habits. So he made this image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. So about a 90-foot statue. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So all those people, I'm going to repeat all that, stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you shall fall down and worship the gold image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." So at that time, when all the people heard the sound of the horn, the flute and the harp and lyre, symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and language fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. This was yet again another test. It was another temptation. And again, the king is not fully convinced of the one true God that the three and Daniel obey. Let's read on. In verse 8. Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. They spoke and said to Nebuchadnezzar, "O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who fears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, shall fall down and worship the gold image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. So there are certain Jews whom you have set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up." Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring the three, so they brought these men before the king. Verse 14, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying to them, "Is it true that you do not serve my gods or worship the gold image which I have set up?" Verse 15, "If you are ready at that time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" Now, I think the king is bipolar or something, because how, once again, can he forget about this? Again, this is now the third situation where this has happened. And I believe even before then, when he made a decree that, and I don't think he was even really fully thinking about it and had completely forgotten about them when he made that, because thinking that everybody would obey that command. This familiar question in the end here, "Who is the God who will deliver you from my hands?" is familiar because we read that same thing in Exodus chapter 5, verse 1 and 2. Exodus chapter 5, verse 1 and 2. "Afterward, Moses and Aaron went in and told Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let my people go, that they may hold a feast to me in the wilderness.' And Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go." See, there's a lot of times where the Bible does repeat itself in different situations, different examples. And here's another one of these. Now, he expected the God whom they worshipped, you know, would not be able to deliver them. And we see that same question posed again in Isaiah chapter 36. Isaiah chapter 36, verse 18 through 20. "Beware, lest Hezekiah persuade you, saying, 'The Lord will deliver us.' Has any one of the gods of the nations delivered its land from the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim?" Something like that. "Indeed, have they delivered Samaria from my hand? Who among all the gods of these lands have delivered their countries from my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem from my hand?" Yeah, they're always going to point out where God supposedly had not delivered, let's say. They'll point that out and remember just that, but notice that God had already delivered them twice before, but not to King Nebuchadnezzar's standards. But that question is asked many times, and in our lifetime could be asked the same thing. So let's look at the reply in verse 16. "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter.'" This reply here was also carefully executed. Notice what Clark's commentary on the Bible says about it. "We are not careful. We have no need to put thee into any farther trouble. We have made up our minds on the subject, and we have our answer ready. Be it known to you, we will not serve your gods." This was as honest as it was decisive. And Christ also tells us that when we are in such a situation, when we are put on the spot, as they were put on the spot here in front of the Hall of Land, how we should answer. Notice Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10, verse 19 and 20. "But when they deliver you up, do not worry about how or what you should speak, for it will be given to you in that hour what you should speak. For it is not you who speak, but the Spirit of your Father which speaks in you." Verse 17, Daniel chapter 3. They continue on saying, "If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O King." This right here showed tremendous faith and trust in God. They showed no doubt of God's ability to save them. If it was his will, they believed that God would do what was best in that circumstance, that they were willing to put it all in God's hands. Notice Isaiah chapter 43, verse 2. Isaiah chapter 43 and verse 2. "When you pass through the waters, I will be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overflow you. When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, nor shall the flame scorch you." So obviously, in terrible times, we know that God is there to protect us. Also notice in Deuteronomy chapter 31, Deuteronomy chapter 31, verse 6. "Be strong and of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid of them, for the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you." Now they understood that. which is why they said what they did. David was also faced with similar situations, and he constantly acknowledged God that he would be protected. Notice Psalm chapter 91. Psalm chapter 91, starting verse 1 through 6, we read, "He who dwells in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my refuge and my fortress, my God, in Him I will trust. Surely He shall deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the perilous pestilence. He shall cover you with His feathers, and under His wings you shall take refuge. His truth shall be your shield and buckler. You shall not be afraid of the terror by night, nor of the arrow that flies by day, nor of the pestilence that walks in darkness, nor of the destruction that lays waste at noonday." Yes, David spoke about this during his time, but this is also a warning for us, and also encouragement for us, because that time is going to come. And this most likely right here is talking about the place of safety, but we have to recognize that. You know, we're not going to be alone, and that God is our shield, and He will be there to protect us when those times will get hard. So, with what we had read there, recognizing the fact that God was there to protect them and to get them through this, there was also that chance, though, that God would not save them, and that they were not afraid to admit that, as we see in the next verse, in verse 18 of Daniel 3. But, I'll back up a little bit, "He will deliver us from your hand, O king." In verse 18, "But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up." They were truly committed to the fact that they would rather die than sin by breaking God's law. This is a tremendous courage and tremendous bravery. Job also had the same attitude, still showing trust in God, in Job chapter 13 and verse 15. Job chapter 13 and verse 15. "Though he," speaking of God, "slay me, yet will I trust him. Even so, I will defend my own ways before him." Now, King Nebuchadnezzar, however, did not see it that way, and it had angered him even more. Notice the next verse in 19 of Daniel 3. "The Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, and the expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace seven times more than it was usually heated." Now, the king here hoped that they would change their minds, and he was indeed surprised by their response, and then knew and was convinced that nothing could be done to persuade them. Because of that, his anger was expressed in the intensity of the furnace to be heated as hot as it could possibly be made. Now, that's already hot. You're still going to die, you know, with the first intensity, but that just shows how angry he was and how blinded he was with anger. Let's continue in verse 20. "He commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments, and were cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Therefore, because the king's command was so urgent, or so harsh, and the furnace exceedingly hot, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these three men fell down bound into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished. He rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, 'Did we not cast three men bound into the midst of the fire?' They answered and said to the king, 'True, O king.' And verse 25, look, he answered, I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God. Now, on the very end of that verse, like the form is like the Son of God, notice Psalms chapter 34 and verse 7. What is also referring to as here. He didn't call him the Son of God. He was just saying like. So in Psalm chapter 34, verse 7, the angel of the Lord encamps all around those who fear him and delivers them. Notice what the Geneva Study Bible comments on this verse. For the angels were called the sons of God because of their excellency. Therefore the king called this angel whom God sent to comfort his own in these great torments, the Son of God. We also see that Daniel expressed the same thing in chapter 6 of Daniel and in verse 22 when he was thrown into the lion's den. In chapter 6 verse 22, my God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouths so that they have not hurt me because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. So he also recognized the fact that it was an angel sent down. So, reading on, clarifies it more, actually, as we continue with the story here. In verse 26 of Daniel 3, then Nebuchadnezzar went near the mouth of the burning fiery furnace and spoke, saying, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God. Now he sees, now he's more convinced, at least in this moment. Come out and come here. Then they came out from the midst of the fire. The satraps, the administrators, governors, and the king's counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants to who trusted in him. And they have frustrated the king's word. Yield their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own God. Therefore, I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces. Their houses shall be made an ash heap because there is no other God who can deliver like this. Verse 30, the king promoted the three in the province of Babylon. So we see then, during these verses here, that the king regarded the fourth individual as an angel. And now, instead of destroying them, he chose to honor them, and now is totally convinced at this moment that there was no other God that could deliver like this. Yet, he kept on referring to as their God because he was not his God and didn't, you know, he wasn't going to worship their God. But there was no other God that could deliver like this, perhaps showing that God's law should be obeyed rather than his. Notice Acts chapter 5, verse 29. Acts chapter 5, verse 29. But Peter and other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. So they recognize that. And so perhaps the way Nebuchadnezzar was trying to explain it was in his own way admitting to that. This also shows another lesson, which is expressed in Proverbs chapter 16 and verse 7 about this entire story. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 7. When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. So going back on the comment about knowing how to answer and in which way you should answer when put on the spot. This verse right here, you know, makes it clear which way is not only going to be pleasing to God, but which way should be the correct way. And when in a situation like that, it is difficult. It is. It's really, really difficult to do. And the way they had acted and their attitude towards all this, just pretty much laying their whole life on the line to do what they were supposed to do, is absolutely tremendous, which is why I absolutely love the story. With these such strong convictions, anything is possible when putting all your trust in God. Now, many out there are going to say that these are just stories, you know, in the Bible. But they're not. I mean, they are true stories, and they're here for our benefit so we can apply the lessons learned in our lives and how they correlate with one another. Like going back to Exodus with Moses, where the same types of questions, the same situations were brought up, and how it ties in with this story, and how it ties in with other stories, and how this story has significant prophetic meaning for what's going to happen in the end time. If people actually understood that, then it would make more sense to them. They choose not to. But what this also shows here is that we are not alone, that many have been in similar situations. They're not as, you know, extreme as this one. And when we go through them, it's proof that God is always there for us, that He will provide, and that He promises protection now and also in the end times. It also shows that we have a responsibility to uphold, that the laws and lessons provided in this book are for our advantage. And they had that wisdom and knowledge, as we do as well, to understand that. Why? So we can all become perfect.